Thank you for tuning in to another terrific episode of our ongoing series, Critical Perspectives with Tony Macklin. Tonight, Tony and I discuss film comedy, from Buster Keaton to Mel Brooks to Judd Apatow. We cover it all in this far-ranging conversation. You can read Tony's criticism and hear his interviews with some of Hollywood's biggest legends at his website, TonyMacklin.net.
The thing that got my mind on this is that I have been watching on television, on Showtime TV, David Steinberg's interviews, Inside Comedy, and they are all very, very interesting. He talks to many of the major comics, male and female, from different generations. And in each of the interviews, people had something that I didn't know. There was something behind them that I didn't know. And it really piqued my interest about comedy. And the more I thought about it, the more I came to some really new conclusions about my own sense of comedy. Now, I know when we start to define what makes people laugh and what is comedy, it is extremely subjective, probably more subjective than any other genre in film. I remember two quick stories. I saw Tommy Smothers out at the Purple Onion, and I went up to him afterwards, and he was getting in a car with a statuous blonde, of course, and I hit it off, and so I followed his career, he and Dickie, and I bought the album, and I had my chairman and his wife, and he was a friend of mine, come over, and we played the album of the Smothers Brothers. They did not smile once. Now, again, when I was teaching out in Santa Barbara in California, somebody had a group of people over, and he played a Jackie Mason album. And I didn't smile. In fact, I frowned and cringed and winced through the whole thing. I thought, I hope not too obviously. And it wasn't, I don't think it was ethnic, because my favorite stand-up comic is Louis Black. I just think he is terrific. But it showed how different all of us were, fairly intelligent people, and we had really strong likes and dislikes, and it's very, very hard to define that.
Yeah. Well, here's 2 points that I want to make based upon what you just said. Yeah, in terms of you watching that show, which is an interview series with a bunch of popular comics, delving into what comedy is to them and how they practice it, is it really something you can define? I mean, once you try to define funny, doesn't it lose the funny?
No, that's like defining anything. Everything is impossible to find. So we use propaganda. We fall back on spin. No, I don't think it's very hard. I mean, for instance, I can tell what most people sense of comedy or appreciation or approach to comedy is as an audience. I'll ask him one question. I'll say, what do you think the Three Stooges? And if somebody really, really likes them, I know the kind of comedy he or she is going to appreciate. And if somebody is left kind of cool by them, as I am, I kind of know the kind of comedy that he's going to enjoy. So that I think there is, once you find the genre, I kind of break it down into, I get it on a film's wavelength, try and find out what the comic is doing, and ask myself, does it kind of deliver on its own terms? Is it funny slapstick, or is it successful slapstick?
Yeah.
I think a lot of slapstick isn't by its very nature funny.
And we don't have a lot,
and
of,
then
we
I judge
a lot
it,
of that it, anymore. We don't have a lot
no,
of
No, we don't.
Slapstick.
No.
We don't have the physical comedy that we used to have. You know, and that's missed, I think.
It is and it isn't. There is physical comedy. For instance, I was talking a minute ago about Lewis Black. He gets absolutely apoplectic in his act, and he's very, very funny. And a lot of it is physical comedy. But and so much of great comedy in the past was not really slapstick. Buster Keaton, who I think is probably the greatest film comedian ever, was not really slapstick. He had this deadpan, stone-faced expression, and he was tremendously ingenious in terms of his creation of using props and being oblivious to what was happening around him. But there was a real intelligence, and it came very close to slapstick.
There was a physical expressiveness. I mean, it was, and I think that most of the comedies that we see today, anyway, the good ones anyway, I mean, they rely mostly on dialogue. They rely on the joke. And I can't think of any actors out there that are popular that have a real physical grace for that kind of comedy, for physical comedy. Can you?
How about Steve Martin?
Okay. Yes. Yep. Yep.
Now he can be the jerk, and he can be silly, and he can make but he's an intelligent. He utilizes his brain power along with his absolute silliness, and it's a knowledge that really works with him.
And he's also one of the few who translate with equal success from stage to film. And when you're talking about a lot of the subjects that David Steinberg interviews in this series, a lot of them haven't found much success in movies. They haven't had vehicles that have tapped into their particular energies. Why is that? I mean, I know they're two different art forms, stand-up comedy and film, but very few of them have success in both arenas.
Well, they're completely different. It's like a baseball player playing football. I wouldn't want to see a film with Lewis Black. I want him to be a stand-up comedian because that's his forte. That's his beautiful, terrific talent. If you put him in a show, he was okay when he appeared on Big Bang Theory in one episode. But on the Jonathan Stewart show, he really isn't very good. He really doesn't have his comfort zone. So you have to have your comfort zone. For instance, Jonathan Stewart, I think he is one of the, in terms of his delivery, he is a terrific actor. He makes the most of a lot of his lines, and he's got a sharp mind, and he's riveting, and when he gets angry, it's truly funny. I saw him on the roast for Don Rickles,
right,
and I thought was awful. He did this ethnic schlock, about blacks and Jews being the minority, and I thought, what are you doing? Maybe they thought that was going to be incisive political comedy, but I think it came very close to shtick. So you have to find your talent, and I think that the stand-up comedian who does lines and language and plays with language. I mean, can you imagine seeing a movie with Stephen Wright? and yet he's extraordinarily funny as a stand-up comedian. So I think it's the old idea of apples and oranges and kumquats and grapes. That they just...
That, Martin Short, anytime I see Martin Short on Letterman or making a TV appearance, I love him. His kind of childlike, giddy, you know, wonder. And I just find him so appealing and funny. But he has no luck in movies. And yet, in dramatic roles, he has tremendous luck. He's mm-hmm. absolutely riveting in drama. And so, obviously, they're two different art forms, but there are very few that I find that have towed both lines with equal success. But In terms of film comedy, who are the poster children for defining the best of film comedy for you?
Well, I have been over this in my mind, my top 15 and the best comics. And so I went back and read James Agee's seminal classic article about silent comedy. And it is perhaps the best article ever written about movie comedy. It appeared in Life in 1949, and it's in his book, Agee on Film. But he's writing about Chaplin and Keaton and all of the great silent comics. And he made an observation about Keaton that suddenly struck me like, boom, it ignited something in me. He said that Keaton, much of his comedy had melancholia. And I'm not sure he didn't mean more melancholy, but I started to think about that. And I started to think, putting down my list, the best of 14 of the top 12 had a sense of sadness or loss and turned it into absurdity. You can mention almost so many of the modern comedies that have this. One of my favorite is Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Mm-hmm. But there is a subtext of loss when we find out what has happened to the John Candy character, and the whole relationship with Steve Martin's character. There's a real palpable sense of loss, and I went down many of my favorite films, and they do have that quality. And suddenly, if you think about opening up melancholy or melancholia to film, so it humanizes. I prefer comedy that is about the human condition and humanism. And my favorite film, my favorite comedy of all time, and a lot of people might just simply not get on its wavelength, but Miloš Forman's Czechoslovakian film and subtitles, it's called The Fireman's Ball, 1967. And I just think it is so human and so, I mean, it straddles the line between, not pathos, I don't much like pathos, but between humor and absurdity and laugh out loud comedy. That is why I keep mentioning that film. I'm not sure anybody has seen it, but I keep mentioning that film as my apogee, as my favorite film comedy. And when you go, Miloš Forman is not basically a comic director, but his view of life and its absurdity, you go back, he won the Oscar for directing in this country, directing One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which won Best Picture. That certainly has moments of great comic timing and the sense of comedy, but it also has a spiritual quality that humanizes one with the experience. It's the same thing with Forman's Amadeus, Forman's Man on the Moon. He is one that has a comic sense, but it is so leavened with bitterness or absurdity or irony. And I think irony is one of the great things that I like in comedy.
Yeah, it's definitely grounded in the, like you said, the absurdity of the human condition, I think. I find that the humor I respond most to, I either enjoy the extremely lowbrow or the more intellectual highbrow. I have very little interest in the center of that, of those two extremes.
give me a couple examples of the lowbrow you appreciate.
I will laugh myself silly. I the hardest I've ever laughed in a film is the first Naked Gun I remember I actually wet myself in the theater. That's the only time that the rat had one silly joke after another, and I just die watching that movie. But I get equal enjoyment out of something like Woody Allen, which his jokes are very much of an intellectual mind, and some of them are highbrow, and they reference kind of highbrow things, and a lot of them come from character, and they're more subtle. Sometimes you're not sure you've heard a punchline, and then you think back on it, and you think, oh, no, that was funny, and that revealed something about character. It wasn't just a laugh for laugh's sake.
But a laugh for laugh's sake is fine if it's done well.
Sure.
And yes, Naked Gun, because it fulfilled two films I like a lot. One is Weekend at Bernie's. Now that certainly is an intellectual experience. One might even call it a guilty pleasure, but I really enjoy that. And a film, in fact, I was surprised at the reaction, at the rating of it, because I remember when it came out, there were a lot of people who were against it. It was What's Up, Doc, Peter Bogdanovich's film with the divine Barbara Streisand, and O'Neill, Ryan O'Neill, and it was in 1972, and I checked it on Rotten Tomatoes, and it really surprised me. It was rated 89, and the audience rating was 89 too. It's a silly, but it's got a sense. It's really appealing. It's a pleasurable experience. So those are two films that I wouldn't say they don't really attract your mind, but they're funny because they deliver on what they're after. And what they're after, I mean, I guess you judge that ultimately, is what they're doing worth doing. But if they do it and they do it well, it probably is worth doing.
What are your thoughts on probably the most acclaimed comedy of the past 20 years, and it's become the ultimate cult film, which is The Big Lebowski?
Well, when I taught, it was the most popular film of the students. I really can't speak because I really don't know. It did nothing for me, and so often when the Coen brothers do something comedic, like that remake of The Lady Killers with Tom Hanks, that I thought was terrible.
Yeah.
Because I remembered the Alec Guinness old British comedies, and that was a storehouse of wonder for me. Who is my favorite female comedian on film? It's probably Margaret Rutherford, who is not one's idea of beauty, charm, or wonder. But I just think her timing is terrific. There's so much admiration for the Coen brothers' Big Lebowski. I don't know whether it was the slacker quality that I don't care about slackers. I don't know whether it just didn't hit me as it. It's other people, and that may be my lack. I mean, it's such a cult film, and it is so popular that...
Well, let me tell you what it is with me. When I saw it the first time, I didn't quite get it, and I hear that from a lot of people. And then rewatching it, it's entirely in the interplay between the characters. It is so beautifully calibrated, and there are no ha-ha joke punchlines in it. But it's entirely comedy of behavior for me, and so the laughs are much deeper. I mean, they resonate more for me. Those are few and far between, particularly with comedies for me. I either find that I have an immediate reaction to it, or I don't have a reaction to it, and I never will. You know.
Well, I should go back and see it again. That's my assignment for next time because I just couldn't find anything that spoke to me, that spoke yeah. personally to me, or about the human condition that I'm a part of, relate to, or respond to. Before, I've lost everybody because I've been not kind to the Three Stooges. I have been alienated from the Big Lebowski. So maybe I can show that we are not prudes. In this show, I think there was an interesting line by Sarah Silverman. She was talking about her comedy, and David Steinberg asked her, what jokes did you tell? And she said, well, I used to tell this all the way back in high school, and I still tell it. She said, I had a friend who breathed out and said, does my breath smell of tacos? And she says, do you put shit in your tacos? Thank you for laughing. There's a tremendous panoply. There's a tremendous sense of, to me, that's very funny. And maybe it's partly her innocent delivery, but it's also a funny joke.
There's something that I respond to in stand-ups, and if you go back to the ones that are considered the greatest, most of them have this in common, which is there's a sense of danger. There's a sense of, yeah, I know where the line is, and I'm about to cross it. So, but the thing that separates a kind of a genius stand-up comic from a merely distasteful one is just the power and the accuracy of the observation.
Right.
No matter how dirty or filthy what they're saying is, as long as it's grounded in some kind of truthful observation that you recognize, it, for me, it's funny. But the element of danger is what I miss in a lot of film comedy, because that's different from gross out. And gross out.
Oh, yes. And what I do not like is broadness. I like depth. I like precision. But broadness, I mean, here's another one that shows I'm out of step with humanity. In Blazing Saddles, one or two farts would have sufficed for me.
Yes. Yes.
And of course, in his new disaster, Seth MacFarlane's new disaster, he takes that farther into using a hat, not just for fart. I mean, obviously Ted worked so well, and I never quite realized how important it was that Wahlberg was in this.
Mm-hmm.
That Ted, he kept it grounded. And as silly, as absurd, as ridiculous, he kept it grounded. When Seth MacFarlane decided to star himself in this broad, he's bland, and he can't carry it. And it's kind of, it's almost, I don't want to say sad because there's ego, there's so much ego involved, but it's disappointing.
Let me ask you about probably the most celebrated lowbrow film comedian, filmmaker, who is Mel Brooks. When I look at this AFI 100 Years, 100 Laughs, where they count down the kind of 100 greatest comedies ever made, I mean, obviously several of Mel Brooks' movies are represented. For me personally, I have to say, outside of Young Frankenstein, maybe this is my deficiency. I have never gotten the appeal of Mel Brooks.
Well, he is over the top, and he does. There's not a whole lot of editing that goes on, and maybe our sense of style gets in the way. I've come out against the Three Stooges and Big Lebowski. I'll be damned if I'm going to come out against Mel Brooks. I mean, what are you
come
trying
on.
To do
come
me
on, make it
to do to me. Now he's inventive, and there's something of value in that. The producers, Blazing Saddles. He's an inventive. The satire, not the parody. He's more parody than satire. He's not really satire. The parody of Hitchcock, and then Young Frankenstein, I think, was a film that I really did like.
That's the one I love. Now, I have no problem with unabashed silliness, which is what he represents to me, but it goes back to the subjective thing. I just don't find it funny. It just doesn't hit me.
Well, there's another thing that it goes on too long.
Mm-hmm.
And anything that goes on too long, like my talking here, begins to turn people off. I think that there's really a lack of control or discipline. The greatest comics have perfect timing and perfect discipline, whether it be Keaton at all. And he's over the top. He's broad. My test of do you like the Three Stooges? People who like the Three Stooges almost have to like Mel Brooks, because he, like the Stooges, is redundant in his comedy and his effects. I admire them. He's not my favorite, but I certainly wouldn't put him on a list of non-funny comedians.
Right. I do laugh at the play. On the Broadway show, the producers. So that's two things that he's created that I laugh at. Do you want to go through the list of AFI?
I want to go through their list and then my list.
Okay. So their top 10 greatest comedies as voted by, I would assume you included, a variety of critics and filmmakers?
Yes, that's correct.
Their number 10 is the Zucker Brothers Airplane, which was groundbreaking for that kind of particular brand of comedy.
Well, let's go one down and say, and Mel Brooks' The Producers was number 11, so
right.
that we include him twice in their top 11.
Yeah, that was the highest rated Mel Brooks. No, it wasn't.
No.
Highest rated is coming up. Yeah, okay.
Right.
Sorry. I remember seeing Airplane. I remember my mother letting me skip school, and she took me to the theater on that opening Friday, and I didn't quite get all the jokes. But those are other movies, the really good Zucker Brothers movies, that you can't get all the jokes because they come at you too fast. Another series of movies that reward repeat viewings, I find.
Right.
And some hit and some don't. But when there are 100 laughs in the span of an hour, that's okay. I mean, you could still hit a pretty great batting average.
Let me interject here. The one thing that bothers me is that the appreciation of film comedy, it's hard sell, or TV comedy. One of the things I detest is soundtrack accompanying The Big Bang Theory. It's like a parasite that leeches the life out of the humor. The humor is funny. It's beautifully delivered by the five main characters, the six main characters, the seven main characters. And yet, somebody will say "the," and the laugh track will go hysterical. And it's almost like when I was a critic, they said, "Oh, you have to see this with an audience." Why do I have to see this with an audience? Because is laughter mob psychology? And there's that quality that when everything is so broad in comedy, everything is so redundant and repetitive, and you have things that, like the laugh track, it really insults our sensibility and our awareness and our perception as an audience. That I can almost not watch that show anymore because of the word "though" or the.
Well, don't you think that, I mean, I know exactly what you're saying, but there have been movies that I've seen by myself, and I found them a lot less effective than when I saw them with an audience. And that's true. That's true a lot of times of comedies and horror films, because there's something infectious about that shared experience. I find laughing.
So you're an orgy kind of guy.
Yeah, I like to spread it around.
Yeah, right. Okay. No, I unfortunately, I think I've said this before. The human race is not my favorite. I'm not a great fan of people. I can be gregarious. I can enjoy people. But sitting in an audience with people who laugh when something isn't funny just because the character don't even hear the line. They start laughing before the line even comes out, even we hear it. And I had an interesting one the other day. I went to see the first show of A Million Ways to Die in the West, and I, like many people, there were really anxious and wanted to see that movie. And boy, the audience, there was an occasional chuckle, an occasional laugh, but they just... It didn't reach them, so maybe they might have helped me, but I don't think so. I understand what you're saying, but I fear the mob. I'm not going to the Nazi theater and laugh unless it's Chaplin playing the great dictator.
Well, and that's not to say that it's a great movie, because I saw the remake of La Cage aux Folles, The Birdcage, when it first came out, and I saw it when I used to manage a theater, so we had to screen the prints the night before it opened. So I was in the theater by myself. I found that I didn't laugh that much. And then I went into the theater the next night with a sold-out house, and it was just riotous laughter. And I said, oh, well, this is kind of funny. But that doesn't make it a great movie that will live in my mind.
No, but
forever,
but that's a wonderful film experience. If you could share in their enthusiasm, and their enthusiasm reached something that you hadn't had alone.
And it's the opposite with The Big Lebowski, because I saw that the first time with a crowd, and I didn't get it. And then I saw it by myself, and there was... And I got it. All of a sudden, I thought to myself, this is the smartest movie ever made about stupid people. That's what I've always thought about.
Maybe in one sentence you hit on my problems with it.
Anyway, okay, number 9 on the AFI list is The Graduate. The pre-production of this movie is kind of infamous on the different kind of variations it took, and the bravery of casting a Dustin Hoffman in the lead, which was the antithesis of the original choice of Robert Redford. But Hoffman is the key to the reason why this movie plays, right?
I would say it's also very, very more. The director, Mike Nichols,
mm-hmm.
because he cast him, they found him off Broadway or wherever he was, and his set pieces are very funny. The guy who wrote the novel, Charles Webb, who I had some dealings with, the movie made what billions of dollars. Do you know how much he got for it? Do you know much he got for the Graduate itself? $25,000.
And no royalties from the film.
No, that's the beginning and end.
Isn't that something?
The thing about The Graduate, that also fits my emphasis on the melancholy and the sense of loss and the sense of desperation, and that becomes absurdity, that... I told you that when I taught it during the 80s, during the 70s, people, when it came out in 67, I think, people were just cheering him, and he was. There were free spirits. During the 80s, and during the Reagan era, the students were saying, well, where are their things? it had totally changed. And I guess Nichols has said several times that he doesn't think they're going to make it. And he's the ending where he captures the, and I guess he had yelled at the two of them because it wasn't working. I guess he had yelled personally at Catherine Ross. So they're submitting to the shock of the director, but it's also the shock of the life and what is their future. So here is a film that appeals to me on a level of the human condition and the ideas that changing the flux that people can experience with that film.
But do you think without it, would it have been as funny with Redford?
No. The guy has to be a nebbish, or has to be. Redford was too good looking.
Right.
Redford was too. No, not at all. I mean, I can't think of any role that comes close to Benjamin Braddock that Redford played.
Well, you would have thought, you know, so an older woman's coming on to you. Why are you so uncomfortable with that? You know, if it was Redford, it's like, of course the woman's coming on to you. I mean, come
yes.
on.
And he probably wouldn't have been uncomfortable. And if he was, it would be a Robert Redford discomfort.
And you
which
believe,
is not...
You would not believe that Robert Redford would be an aimless, kind of directionless person either.
What his early films, maybe this was it. Maybe this was why they were after him first. His early films, Downhill Racer and The Candidate, he played, and he did a beautiful job with them. He played empty, hollow figures. Mm. There was no humanity to them. They were going through life, but they were superficial, and Redford brought it up. I mean, brought it across. And I always thought, I wish that Robert Redford had gone through, of course, the way we were, probably destroyed any possibilities of that, of him portraying a character who was empty.
Right.
And people didn't want to see him as an empty character either. But
well, and
but,
also with the aimless thing, some not necessarily aimless, but I don't buy him as someone who is not a go-getter. And even in The Candidate, I mean, he's fiercely competitive, but at the end of that film, whatever his last line is, which is something akin to once he wins and he says, what do I do now?
Yes.
Yeah. He fit perfectly for that, but I can't buy him as someone lazy, I guess is what I'm saying.
Well, I don't think Benjamin was lazy. Benjamin was caught in a situation that was empty. Not that he was empty. He just submitted to it. Now Redford would have submitted. I'm defending casting Redford now. Redford would have submitted to it in a different way. It would have been a completely different film. But yes, Redford, I think, could have managed it with a totally different from a totally different slant. And he can be very, very aimless. And very, I mean, the character in The Way We Were is a materialistic, fairly superficial individual.
But
and,
my God,
what a
great contrast of pairings. And of course, they were together in All the President's Men just to spectacular effect. But when you think about the definition of a leading man, I mean, you can't get more polar opposite than Redford and Hoffman. But casting Hoffman in that movie in place of Redford kind of changed the definition of what a leading man could be. I mean, that's
yes.
the big legacy of that film. And, you know.
Well, and also remember Marty. Remember
sure.
Ernest Borgnine as Marty. So during the 60s, we were making more personal films that didn't have to have leading men as expected leading men. They could go down different paths.
I just watched Marty for the first time about 4 or 5 months ago.
Did it hold up at all?
It's the first time I ever watched it. I said, what a beautiful-hearted movie.
Nice. Good. I'm glad to hear that. She was excellent. She was very good.
I've been trying to invest more in classic cinema. I have a lot of gaps there. So I've been taping everything on TCM. Number 8, It Happened One Night, speaking of classic cinema. Any opposition there?
No, not at all. It's a classic film. Very well done. No problem.
Number 7, MASH, Robert Altman's MASH. Now, let's talk about kind of a groundbreaking, what the hell is this kind of movie when that came out.
Well, not only that, when they were making the film, Elliot Gould and Sutherland went to the producer to try and get Robert Altman fired.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they said he doesn't know what he's doing. It's such a mess. And also, you know that Altman hated the comedy that was on TV.
Yeah, the comedy.
He thought everything about he had wanted to. I hate the term, so I won't use it. Push the blank. And he brought blood, and he brought death, and he brought pain, and he brought alienation and irony and self-gratification and a spiritual experience, but a very quirky, very unsettling one. And I like the TV show, but Altman just detested it.
I think here's an interesting tidbit about MASH that I read, and I would imagine maybe it's true. But my understanding is that's the first film that had the F word in it.
Oh.
Did you know that?
I think Frigidaire was in some other movie.
You think what? You think... Did you say Frigidaire?
Yeah. Hey, fuck is fuck is fuck, fuck, fuck.
All right, that's our soundbite for the show. Okay. So number 6 is Blazing Saddles. We've touched upon that with Mel Brooks' comedy. Number 5 is Duck Soup, which is, it's obviously always on the list of greatest comedies. What's your
Marx
take on the Marx Brothers in general?
Now, talk about hit or miss, but when it hit, it was sublime.
Yeah. I don't know why... I guess I kind of understand why Annie Hall, which is at number 4, is kind of the most beloved Woody Allen film, even though it's not in my list of favorites, but there it is at number 4.
Ironically, it's more mainstream than any other film I think he ever made. That there is satire in it, but the satire is so muted, and the performances, especially Diane Keaton's performance, so transcend the satiric qualities that it worked with a fairly general audience. And I think that's why I think it's his most universal, and it was a comedy with heart. And comedies with heart are the only comedies that succeed with the Academy.
Right. Maybe that's why I don't respond to it as well as the other Woody Allen movies. It has heart. Okay. Their number 3, pretty much the greatest satire ever.
Yes.
Dr. Strangelove. First of all, when we talked about stand-up comedy and the danger of that, that's exactly what I love about Dr. Strangelove. How dare he make a comedy about nuclear annihilation? But he does.
But it was funny. It was the absurdity was so real, so true. It has such credibility. And remember also, the thing about Dr. Strangelove, it's not just an outer left field satire. Peter Sellers is extraordinary in the different roles that he plays, from President Merkin Muffley to Dr. Strangelove himself. And George C. Scott, eight scenery, but he made it a feast. I mean, it was wonderful. And Sterling Hayden, and the whole script, it started out, it was based on a novel that was straight, that was serious.
Red Alert. And they were also making that as a straight drama. And they were sitting around brainstorming, and they said, "What, these guys in the war room, what happens if they like need to order a pizza or something?" And they started laughing, and they said, "You know," Kubrick said, "You know, this whole thing is absurd. Maybe we should make this a comedy." But that's what I'm saying. I mean, the danger of it from the thematic standpoint, from the point of view of having Sellers play three different roles, to the accuracy of the actual procedures. In case of that kind of war, where people were saying, "How did he get this information?"
Wonderful ending with Vera Lynn singing, "We'll be together again," as the mushroom cloud
and
goes up.
Timing is everything. This movie, it was made in the thick of it. I mean, there was little distance. This was everyone's fear at the time, and and they made a comedy and a satire on it, and the great satires bring out a deeper truth, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
A bitterness or a fear underneath those laughs that stick.
But so much great humor is on the basis of agony, anguish, angst, that people in a horrible situation, but all they have left is to keep their own humanity and their own, quote, dignity, unquote, so that is their sense of humor. And I think we all have that. We all appreciate it in different ways. But humor, I think maybe, I look at this absurd culture, and I don't know whether I could live without Lewis Black making scornful comments about it. That so much of humor is taking an impossible, hopeless, hapless situation and shining a light that glitters and sparkles and has a truth to it. I think even though people try their hardest, spend their whole lives trying to avoid the truth, it seems like comedy often gets them to stumble into the truth.
Yeah. Yeah. They're number two. This is largely known as the greatest comedy of the past 30-some-odd years. Tootsie, which I was just talking about Tootsie yesterday, in that I think now, I mentioned this with The Graduate, but I do think the strength of Tootsie is entirely in Dustin Hoffman's persona as well, because it very smartly and bravely plays off that persona. Hoffman was the pain in the ass actor. I mean, he was always known as that, and he was lampooning that. And at the same time, there's genuine exploration of gender inequality. I mean, another movie that finds the truth behind the laugh.
Yes, yes. Beautifully done. Absolutely.
And I make it akin to what Beatty tried to do with Shampoo, which is kind of playing off his persona of the lover playboy in a similar way.
Well, he also had Hal Ashby.
Yeah.
Wasn't that Ashby who directed that?
Yeah, but he pushed him around. I mean, it's basically...
Yeah, but Hal Ashby got pushed around by Peter Sellers on being there. But you start to look at his films, and his being pushed around is not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, I'm crazy about Hal Ashby. So, but
oh, okay, good.
Yeah, so I'm on board the Ashby train.
Okay.
But any other thoughts about Tootsie or Hoffman and Tootsie?
Just the whole cast. It was an ensemble, an immaculate ensemble.
And it could have been a very slapsticky plot. I mean, the man dressed up as a woman that falls in love with his female co-star, the woman of his dreams, but the female co-star's father falls in love with him. I mean,
it's ridiculous. But it's the human condition, because when it got to be absurd, they pulled it back to humanity and the validity in human interaction and the credibility and the believability of human interaction.
Mm. And anyone that hasn't seen it, go on YouTube. There's a clip of Dustin Hoffman talking about why he wanted to do Tootsie. And it's a really kind of emotional clip. And he starts to cry and starts to talk about, when he dressed up.
The only thing I didn't like the ending. I thought the ending, I'm waiting for a climactic ending, maybe like Fargo last night or the other night. And the ending just kind of drifts off. It's not, I mean, I think it could have been a much stronger ending, but that's so often the truth. The next film we're going to talk about, I don't know how to deal with the ending of this. Some Like It Hot was the number one. How do you deal with Joey Brown? Was that who it was?
The one that uttered the nobody's perfect line?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The rest of the film had, you could make, it was credible. As absurd or as nonsensical as it was, I think that line probably works. But here's a tremendous incongruity, and that also can be very much a part of comedy, that you offer the incongruity.
Well, it's amazing to me because you recommended that I go to Westwood Cemetery, and there's they're buried together, well, side by side, practically, Jack Lemmon and Billy Wilder, and then right across the way, Marilyn Monroe. It's almost like the Some Like It Hot Cemetery.
Jeez. I didn't know that. I think the last time I went, Lemon was still alive, so
yeah.
Wow.
Lemon and Mathau are side by side. Now, I don't know where Tony Curtis is, and then Billy Wilder's on that same row. And Billy Wilder has Nobody's Perfect on his tombstone.
If Tony Curtis weren't Jewish, I'd say he's in purgatory. But I don't know where he is either.
Here we are mining comedy from tragedy. So how does your top 10 differ?
Okay, my top 10, and I will go through these fairly quickly. It's As Good as It Gets. I thought Jack was terrific in that, Nicholson. And I was really disappointed when Greg Kinnear didn't win the Oscar, but he lost to Robin Williams in Good Will Hunting. But to me, that is a laugh out line at Jack's delivery of some lines. I think it's him at his comic best.
Yeah, I think so too. And when he's on fire, James L. Brooks, there are few better writers out there because of the observational powers that he has. And I think of As Good as It Gets, I think of Broadcast News, particularly a character like the Holly Hunter character in that film, which for me is one of the most amazingly written female characters since that movie came out.
He liked actresses with the initials HH, right? Wasn't Helen Hunt in As Good as It Gets?
That's true. Yes. Okay, you've cracked the code. Yes.
Then I've got Tootsie. Then one, the best sports comedy, if you consider horse racing a sport, Let It Ride. Joe Pitka's, I think, his only film. Yeah, I love that film.
Isn't that Paul Mazursky? Didn't Mazursky do that?
No. No. Okay. Richard, Joe Petka from Pittsburgh. I think it was a one-time film with Richard Dreyfuss.
Right.
As the gambler.
Jennifer Tilly, yeah.
Yes, yes. And it just, talk about a film that is just enjoyable. Maybe other people are enjoying being with the slacker at in Lebowski, but I enjoy being with the racetrack tout with Richard Dreyfuss. So that's high on my list.
And Dreyfuss in comedy, I mean, he was always able to find the humor in anything, but he has this manic energy.
Yes.
That is really infectious. It's what I found infectious about a lot of what Michael Keaton would do when he was in a really good comedy.
Right.
You know. So.
Well, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe Lewis Black could make a racetrack movie. He can be apoplectic as they come down the stretch. Maybe he could do that.
But it's got to be. I think the difference is stand-up comics build their own persona based upon whatever act they want to pursue, you know.
Right.
And I don't know that can't work in movies generally.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
You know.
Being there, Hal Ashby's.
Oh, gosh,
I think I think Peter Sellers. Unfortunately, it seems like he's almost forgotten these days. I refuse to use the word. I keep saying I refuse to the word, and then come very close to it. I refuse to use this word. I'm going to use it. So I refuse to use it except one time. I don't think that there's comic genius. I think that Einstein was a genius. There are comic masters. There are comic. But this idea, comic genius, always I cringe when I hear that. But he's as good a master, Peter Sellers, as there has been in most years.
Sure. And another satire. If you put Being There alongside a satire like Dr. Strangelove, I mean, tonally they're different because, as is Hal Ashby's trademark, Being There felt very gentle.
Right.
But it's still in its own way. It's a biting satire and a prophetic one. You know, of how we've gotten to where we are now.
It's actually a gumming satire. It's not biting. Mm. It's not sharp in terms of being penetrating or incisive, but it's so there. It's so much a part of the characters.
I think that last shot kind of cements it as it's almost like a shock of realization that this is exploring like a deeper implication. When he and what's shocking to me is how they came up with that shot on the day. They said, "Well, when you're walking across the water, why don't you try walking across the water?" And then they said, "Well, uh-huh. dip your umbrella in the water so people know that it's not a shallow water and
right.
you're actually walking
right.
on it." And I mean, that's just the last note that just that stays with you. That movie stays with you.
The comedies that I have on my list and you had on your list or we had on the AFI's list, do you notice how many of them are beautifully acted?
Yeah. Yeah.
That whether it be Tootsie or As Good As It Gets or whatever it is or certainly Some Like It Hot, there's exquisite acting in them. Now, here I've got a pair of Christmas stories on my list. One is The Christmas Story that I don't think that has my melancholia quality that I'm looking for, but it has Darren McGavin, and it's a funny film. But the one that does have my melancholia is Christmas Carol, and it has an absolutely exquisite performance by Alistair Sim as Scrooge. When he is gleeful, when he realizes that he is alive, and he is just so delighted, the credibility of life, the amazingness of life. It is one of the finer moments in all film comedy. So I put Christmas Carol. I have Dr. Strangelove, Trains, Planes, and Automobiles. And that, as I said, is also melancholia because Candy's wife has died and the other, Steve Martin's character is trying to get home for the holidays. It's a comedy that works on a multiplicity of levels. What's Up, Doc, which I've mentioned before. Now I get really, really, really personal here. My fifth one is The Time of Their Lives. Do you know who was in it?
No.
Abbott and Costello. And it's, they play revolutionary ghosts or ghosts from the Revolutionary War. And it is a beautifully done. The special effects way back when in 46 are very, very clever. And I think it's their finest film. I was a fan of theirs because I grew up with Raisinettes and Tootsie Rolls and Evan Costello and the Bowery Boys. Then my fourth favorite, which is the only one of my top seven or eight that isn't melancholic, or doesn't have that melancholia strain. Not any Bowery Boys, but the best of the Bowery Boys, probably the Bowery Boys versus the Monsters in 54 and Masterminds in 49, but probably Meet the Monsters. And where I was mentioned, first time it was mentioned kind of nationally, was when they had the best actors, AFI, and I included with one of my best actors, Hunts Hall. And of course, it was just homage. He was not one of the greatest actors that ever was on the screen, but he was. I loved him, and I got to talk to him on the phone. And the L.A. Times, I forget his last name right now, but he wrote an article about this guy who had said that Hunts Hall was worthy of recognition and consideration. And then the third is the Gold Rush, Charlie Chaplin, which has the potato scene, the dance of the potatoes. Yes.
And the shoe? Is the shoe?
Is yes, the and rush? The eating okay. The shoes, yeah, right.
I just
and
watched it, that a couple of months ago.
Yeah. It's hallucination and it's psychology. Chaplin had a great sense of psychology. If you've ever seen Monsieur Verdoux, which is an unknown film because it's a kind of serious satiric film, he was a very good psychologist. Then I prefer a little bit The General because of Buster Keaton. I think Buster Keaton probably, in my mind, created the purest comedy. There was no fluff. There didn't seem to be any ego. There was surprise, and you just saw when the building fell, but he's standing in the door just so he doesn't get hit. And when you go and see Sherlock Jr. and you see the use of film in the theater, when you go and see The Navigator, and the wonderful sense of palpable silence, there's a purity to Buster Keaton's films that people just are not familiar with. And then my number one is The Fireman's Ball, the Czechoslovakian. It just spoke to me. You know how sometimes there's something that comes along and speaks to you. This is laugh out funny for me. people may think it's unkind or it's cruel because it shows human nature at its fallible and greedy and the gray, if not dark, sides of human nature. But it's to me, if I had one film to cherish, it probably would be his. And then when I saw what Milos Forman did in the rest of his career, it makes me kind of proud to be a fan of his from the very beginning.
Yeah. Let me talk about the trend of comedy, because in the 80s we started kind of on the heels of Animal House, we started kind of a frat boy kind of comedy, and now we're in the phase of the gross out comedy kind of died off, and now we're, for the most part, and now we're in the Judd Apatow school of comedy.
Right.
Comedy with a heart, but to varying degrees of success. But
well, I can always go back. If I get annoyed at Judd Apatow, I go back and realize, like I do with Milos Forman, that man created Freaks and Geeks.
And another.
But I think he also has gotten. You know, who are you? Oh, I'm Judd Apatow. Therefore, I have to. You know, I don't want to say he's in a rut, but it's how much how much more does he expand? How much more? If I see, I shouldn't dislike James Franco. I really shouldn't. But I am so tired of James Franco doing everything.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what happens when you create your own brand. And I think that's what Apatow has done. I think that's what the Farrelly brothers did in the 90s.
Right.
And all of a sudden other filmmakers pick up on that, and then the Farrelly brothers try to return back to that brand of comedy, and they've been outgunned at the game that they invented by that point. And
right.
I think that's probably what will happen to Judd Apatow. But there is – I watched a comedy a couple of weeks ago. I've seen it several times. But I also like – I don't know how to put it, but I also like painful, uncomfortable comedy at times. I love Larry David's show, Curb Your Enthusiasm. That
right.
really makes me laugh. But I rewatched The King of Comedy last week.
Okay.
Which that's about as painful a comedy as uncomfortable and unnerving. Every scene is just so unnerving. But I mean, technically, that's a comedy, right?
Sure, I would. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's a serious drama based on with comic overtones. But I would include it under comedy. The dark comedy or the discomforting, the unsettling comedy that you said.
Yeah, very much so. And another movie that is prophetic about celebrity culture. And what exactly does this guy want from Jerry Lewis? I mean, what does he really
right.
want? It's frightening. Okay.
I think today some of the funniest movie I've seen so far is Bad Words, the Jason Bateman film.
Oh, I haven't seen that yet.
This year, it's just clever. It's not a great comedy, but I love language, and I liked what they did with language. And then it kind of volleys or with Veep on television, which has the most creative, inventive cursing on the air today, and it is the delivery and the absurdity. Have you seen Veep at all?
I've watched an episode or two. Yeah.
Okay. Maybe you have to get into it. I don't know.
It's not something I've investigated. I mean, I've passed it on TV, so I mean, I haven't made a concerted effort to check it out yet.
My it seems maybe my funny bone has shrunken. I mean, not like the rest of me. Nothing else has shrunken. but my funny bones may have. But television seems to be, I still think if I could cut out that, kill the producer who does the soundtrack, the laugh track, I still like Big Bang Theory. I think that the comedy, and the new one, the Silicon Valley, is mm-hmm. kind of tongue-in-cheek, and it's off the wall, and it's offbeat, and you really have to make an effort to somehow relate or somehow allow the characters to exist in your mind, because mm-hmm. some of them are absurd and not... And fairly distasteful, but it's a good show. Silicon Valley is a good show.
And there's some comedies that I've seen Silicon Valley, and I do laugh at that. I haven't checked out Louie, even though people keep demanding that I do.
I think you should. The thing about Louie is it's so a little bit of Louie goes a long way.
Uh-huh.
And I know. He is very creative and very imaginative, and his comedy goes to different places, and he has the balls that Sarah Silverman has figuratively.
Right.
That there's something just in the boldness of it. Sometimes it delivers. It's sporadic. I mean, I think it's sporadic. But he's likable. He's likable as this character who is pretty unlikable. And it's a nice chemistry.
And going back to the subjective thing, I mean, some of these I can't defend, other than to just say they make me laugh silly, which is essentially what it comes down to, it the job of a comedy. So something like The Man with Two Brains makes me laugh silly. But at the same time, I can't get on board with Monty Python. I've never been a Python film fan, and I know there's a huge cult around Monty Python.
I'm not saying anything. Sergeant Schultz has just arrived. He's not. I'm not. I am saying nothing.
Okay.
But I think the subjectivity, what is so key to it, and I keep returning to this, is that does it deliver on what it tries to do, or
yeah.
does it fake it? And I think that does. You may not appreciate it or like it, or you may get tired of whatever the work may be, but it at least is not an insult to our intelligence, and good comedy on any level achieves some kind of connection with its target audience. And we are certainly different. Some people are conservatives who will never love liberal comedy. And if there were such a thing as conservative comedy, there are liberals who would never like conservative comedy.
But there
when it's invented, that'll be a nice accomplishment.
Huh?